he was a boy, a mad, furious, scolding tirade, and her face looked angry too, the mouth wide, the eyes staring, the hair disarrayed. The conviction that she was demanding something grew, and he felt himself becoming younger and smaller, until he was possessed by a blind terror he had not felt since childhood, a terror that came from knowing that the only person he loved was a raging monster. It had always been like this. She would tell him to come to her, or go away, or get his pony, or get off, and he would be slow to respond, so she would yell, and then he would be so frightened that he could not understand what she was asking him to do, and there would be a hysterical deadlock, with her screaming louder and louder and him becoming blind, deaf, and dumb with terror. But this time it was different. This time she died. First her eyes closed. William began to feel calmer then. Gradually her breathing became shallower. Her face went grayish despite the boils. Even the candle seemed to burn more weakly, and the moving shadows no longer frightened William. At last her breathing just stopped. "There," William said. "She's all right now, isn't she?" The maid burst into tears. He sat beside the bed looking at her still face. The maid fetched the priest, who said angrily, "Why didn't you call me earlier?" William hardly heard him. He stayed with her until sunrise. Then the women servants asked him to leave so they could lay her out. William went down to the hall where the inhabitants of the castle, knights, men-at-arms, clergymen, and servants, were eating a subdued breakfast. He sat at the table beside his young wife and drank some wine. One or two of the knights and the household steward spoke to him, but he did not reply. Eventually Walter came in and sat beside him. Walter had been with him for many years, and he knew when to be silent. After a while, William said, "Are the horses ready?" Walter looked surprised. "For what?" "For the journey to Kingsbridge. It takes 2 days. We have to leave this morning. I didn't think we would go, under the circumstances." For some reason this made William angry. "Did I say we wouldn't go?" "No, Lord." "Then we're going!" "Yes, Lord." Walter stood up. "I'll see to it at once." They set off at mid-morning, William and Elizabeth and the usual entourage of knights and grooms. William felt as if he was in a dream. The landscape seemed to move past him instead of the other way around. Elizabeth rode beside him, bruised and silent. When they stopped, Walter took care of everything. At each meal, William ate a little bread and drank several cups of wine. In the night he dozed fitfully. They could see the cathedral from a distance across the green fields as they approached Kingsbridge. The old cathedral had been a squat, broad-shouldered building with small windows like beady eyes under round-arched eyebrows. The new church looked radically different, even though it was not finished yet. It was tall and slender, and the windows seemed impossibly big. As they came closer, William saw that it dwarfed the priory buildings around it in a way that the old cathedral never had. The road was busy with riders and pedestrians all heading for Kingsbridge. The Whitsunday service was popular, for it took place in early summer when the weather was good and the roads were dry. This year more people than usual had come, attracted by the novelty of the new building. William and his party cantered the last mile, scattering unwary pedestrians, and clattered onto the wooden drawbridge that crossed the river. Kingsbridge was now one of the most heavily fortified towns in England. It had a stout stone wall with a castellated parapet, and here, where previously the bridge had led straight into the main street, the way was barred by a stone-built barbican with enormously heavy iron-bound doors that now stood open, but were undoubtedly shut tight at night. "I don't suppose I'll ever be able to burn this town again," William thought vaguely. People stared as he rode up the main street toward the priory. People always stared at William, of course, he was the Earl. Today they were also interested in the young bride who rode at his left. On his right was Walter, as always. They rode into the priory close and dismounted at the stables. William left his horse to Walter and turned to look at the church. The eastern end, the top of the cross, was at the far side of the close and hidden from view. The western end, the tail of the cross, was not yet built, but its shape was marked out on the ground with stakes and string, and some of the foundations had already been laid. Between the two was the new part, the arms of the cross, consisting of the north and south transepts with the space between them, which was called the crossing. The windows were as big as they had seemed. William had never seen a building like this in his life.
"It's fantastic,"
Elizabeth said, breaking her submissive silence. William wished he had left her behind. Somewhat awestruck, he walked slowly up the nave between the lines of stakes and string, with Elizabeth following. The first bay of the nave had been partly built, and looked as if it was supporting a huge pointed arch which formed the western entrance to the crossing. William passed under that incredible arch and found himself in the crowded crossing. The new building looked unreal. It was too tall, too slender, too graceful and fragile to stand up. It seemed to have no walls, nothing to hold up the roof but a row of willowy piers, reaching eloquently upward. Like everyone around him, William craned his neck to look up, and saw that the piers continued into the curved ceiling to meet at the crown of the vault, like the overarching branches of a stand of mature elms in the forest. The service began. The altar had been set up at the near end of the chancel, with the monks behind it, so that the crossing and both transepts were free for the congregation, but even so the crowd overflowed into the unbuilt nave. William pushed his way to the front, as was his prerogative, and stood near the altar with the other nobles of the county, who nodded to him and whispered among themselves. The painted timber ceiling of the old chancel was awkwardly juxtaposed with the tall eastern arch of the crossing, and it was clear that the builder intended eventually to demolish the chancel and rebuild it to match the new work. A moment after that thought had crossed William's mind, his eye fell on the builder in question, Jack Jackson. He was a handsome devil with his mane of red hair, and he wore a dark red tunic embroidered at the hem and neckline, just like a nobleman. He looked rather pleased with himself, no doubt because he had built the transept so fast and everyone was so astonished by his design. He was holding the hand of a boy about 9 years old, who looked just like him. William realized with a shock that that must be Aliena's child, and he felt a sharp pang of envy. A moment later he caught sight of Aliena herself. She was standing a little behind Jack and to one side with a faint smile of pride on her face. William's heart leaped. She was as lovely as ever. Elizabeth was a poor substitute, a pallid imitation of the real red-blooded Aliena. In her arms Aliena held a little girl about 7 years old, and William recalled that she had had a second child by Jack, even though they were not married. William looked more closely at Aliena. She was not quite as lovely as ever, after all. There were lines of strain around her eyes, and behind the proud smile was a hint of sadness. After all these years she still could not marry Jack, of course, William thought with satisfaction. Bishop Walleran had kept his promise and had repeatedly blocked the annulment. That thought often gave William consolation. It was Walleran, William now realized, who was standing at the altar lifting the host above his head, so that the entire congregation could see it. Hundreds of people went down on their knees. The bread became Christ at that moment, a transformation that struck awe into William, even though he had no idea what was involved. He concentrated on the service for a while, watching the mystical actions of the priests, listening to the meaningless Latin phrases and muttering familiar fragments of the responses. The dazed feeling that had been with him for the last day or so persisted, and the magical new church, with sunlight playing on its impossible columns, served to intensify the sense that he was in a dream. The service was coming to an end. Bishop Walleran turned to address the congregation.
"We will now pray for the soul of Countess Regan Hamley, the mother of Earl William of Shiring, who died on Friday night."
There was a buzz of comment as people heard the news, but William was staring at the bishop in horror. He had realized at last what she had been trying to say while she died. She had been asking for the priest, but William had not sent for him. He had watched her weaken. He had seen her eyes close. He had heard her breathing stop. And he had let her die unshriven. How could he have done something like that? Ever since Friday night, her soul had been in hell, suffering the torments that she had described to him so graphically many times, with no prayers to relieve her. His heart was so laden with guilt that he seemed to feel it slow its pace, and for a moment he felt that he too would die. How could he have let her languish in that dread place, her soul disfigured by sins, as her face was with boils, while she longed for the peace of heaven? "What am I going to do?" he said aloud, and the people around him looked at him in surprise. When the prayer ended, and the monks filed out in procession, William remained on his knees in front of the altar. The rest of the congregation drifted out into the sunshine, ignoring him, all except Walter, who stayed nearby, watching and waiting. William was praying with all his might, keeping a picture of his mother in his head while he repeated the Paternoster and all the other bits of prayers and services he could remember. After a while he realized there were other things he could do. He could light candles. He could pay priests and monks to say masses for her regularly. He could even have a special chapel built for the benefit of her soul. But everything he thought of seemed insufficient. It was as if he could see her, shaking her head, looking hurt and disappointed in him, saying, "How long will you let your mother suffer?" He felt a hand on his shoulder and looked up. Bishop Walleran stood in front of him, still wearing the gorgeous red robe he used for Whitsun. His black eyes looked deep into William's, and William felt as if he had no secrets from that penetrating gaze. Walleran said, "Why do you weep?" William realized his face was wet with tears. He said, "Where is she?" "She has gone to be purified by fire." "Is she in pain?" "Terrible pain. But we can speed the souls of our loved ones as they pass through that dread place." "I'll do anything," William sobbed. "Just tell me what." Walleran's eyes glittered with greed. "Build a church," he said, "just like this one, but in Shiring." A cold fury possessed Aliena whenever she travelled around the estates that had been part of her father's earldom. All the blocked ditches and broken fences and empty tumble-down cowsheds angered her. The meadows running to seed made her sad, and the deserted villages broke her heart. It was not just the bad harvests. The earldom could have fed its people, even this year, if it had been properly run. But William Hamley had no notion of husbanding his land. For him, the earldom was a private treasure chest, not an estate that fed thousands of people. When his serfs had no food, they starved. When his tenants could not pay their rents, he threw them out. Since William became earl, the acreage under cultivation had shrunk, because the lands of some dispossessed tenants had returned to their natural state, and he did not have the brains to see that this was not even in his own interest in the long term. The worst of it was, Aliena felt partly responsible. It was her father's estate, and she and Richard had failed to win it back for the family. They had given up when William became earl and Aliena lost all her money, but the failure still rankled, and she had not forgotten her vow to her father. On the road from Winchester to Shiring, with a wagon load of yarn and a brawny carter with a sword at his belt, she remembered riding along the very same road with her father. He had constantly brought new land into cultivation by clearing areas of forest, draining marshland, or ploughing hillsides. In bad years, he always put aside enough seed to supply the needs of those who were too improvident or just too hungry to save their own. He never forced tenants to sell their beasts or their ploughs to pay rent, for he knew if they did that, they would be unable to farm the following year. He had treated the land well, maintaining its capacity to produce, the way a good farmer would take care of a dairy cow. Whenever she thought of those old days with her clever, proud, rigid father beside her, she felt the pain of loss like a wound. Life had started to go wrong when he had been taken away. Everything she had done since then seemed in retrospect to have been hollow. living at the castle with Matthew in a dream world, going to Winchester in the vain hope of seeing the king, even struggling to support Richard while he fought in the Civil War. She had achieved what other people saw as success. She had become a prosperous wool merchant, but that had brought her only a semblance of happiness. She had found a way of life and a place in society that gave her security and stability, but in her heart she had still been hurt and lost, until Jack came into her life. Her inability to marry Jack had blighted everything since. She had come to hate Prior Philip, whom she had once looked up to as her savior and mentor. She had not had a happy, amiable conversation with Philip for years. Of course it was not his fault that they could not get an annulment, but it was he who had insisted they live apart, and Aliena could not help resenting him for that. She loved her children, but she worried about them, being brought up in such an unnatural household with a father who went away at bedtime. So far, happily, they showed no ill effects. Tommy was a strapping, good-looking boy who liked football, races, and playing soldiers, and Sally was a sweet, thoughtful girl who told stories to her dolls and loved to watch Jack at his tracing floor. Their constant needs and their simple love were the one solidly normal element in Aliena's eccentric life. She still had her work, of course. She had been a merchant of some kind for most of her adult life. At present she had dozens of men and women in scattered villages spinning and weaving for her in their homes. A few years ago there had been hundreds, but she was feeling the effects of the famine like everyone else, and there was no point in making more cloth than she could sell. Even if she were married to Jack, she would still want to have her own independent work. Prior Philip kept saying the annulment could be granted any day. But Aliena and Jack had now been living this infuriating life for 7 long years, eating together and bringing up their children and sleeping apart. She felt Jack's unhappiness more painfully than her own. She adored him. Nobody knew how much she loved him, except perhaps his mother, Ellen, who saw everything. She loved him because he had brought her back to life. She had been like a caterpillar in a cocoon, and he had drawn her out and shown her that she was a butterfly. She would have spent her entire life numb to the joys and pains of love if he had not walked into her secret glade and shared his story poems with her and kissed her so lightly, and then slowly, gently, awakened the love that lay dormant in her heart. He had been so patient, so tolerant, despite his youth. For that she would always love him. As she passed through the forest, she wondered whether she would run into Jack's mother, Ellen. They saw her occasionally at a fair in one of the towns, and about once a year she would sneak into Kingsbridge at dusk and spend the night with her grandchildren. Aliena felt an affinity for Ellen. They were both oddities, women who did not fit into the mould. However, she emerged from the forest without seeing Ellen. As she travelled through farmland, she checked the crops ripening in the fields. It would be a fair harvest, she estimated. They had not had a good summer, for there had been some rain, and it had been cold. But they had not had the floods and crop diseases which had blighted the last 3 harvests. Aliena was thankful. There were thousands of people living right on the edge of starvation, and another bad winter would kill most of them. She stopped to water her oxen at the pond in the middle of a village called Monksfield, which was part of the Earl's estate. It was a fairly large place, surrounded by some of the best land in the county, and it had its own priest and a stone church. However, only about half the fields round about had been sown this year. Those that had been were now covered with yellow wheat, and the rest were sprouting weeds. 2 other travellers had stopped at the pond in the middle of the village to water their horses. Aliena looked at them warily. Sometimes it was good to team up with other people for mutual protection, but it could be risky, too, for a woman. Aliena found that a man such as her carter was perfectly willing to do what she told him when they were alone, but if other men were present he was liable to become insubordinate. However, 1 of the 2 travellers at Monksfield Pond was a woman. Aliena looked more closely and revised woman to girl. Aliena recognized her. She had last seen this girl in Kingsbridge Cathedral on Whitsunday. It was Countess Elizabeth, the wife of William Hamley. She looked miserable and cowed. With her was a surly man-at-arms, obviously her bodyguard. That could have been my fate, Aliena thought, if I had married William. Thank God I rebelled. The man-at-arms nodded curtly to the carter and ignored Aliena. She decided not to suggest teaming up. While they were resting, the skies turned black and a sharp wind whipped up. "Summer storm," said Aliena's carter succinctly. Aliena looked anxiously at the sky. She did not mind getting wet, but the storm would slow their progress, and they might find themselves out in the open at nightfall. A few drops of rain fell. They would have to take shelter, she decided reluctantly. The young countess said to her guard, "We'd better stay here for a bit."
"Can't do that," the guard said brusquely. "Master's orders."
Aliena was outraged to hear the man speak to the girl that way.
"Don't be such a fool," she said. "You're supposed to look after your mistress."
The guard looked at her in surprise.
"What's it to you?" he said rudely.
"There's going to be a cloudburst, idiot," Aliena said in her most aristocratic voice. "You can't ask a lady to travel in such weather. Your master will flog you for your stupidity."
Aliena turned to Countess Elizabeth. The girl was looking eagerly at Aliena, visibly pleased to see someone standing up to the bullying bodyguard. It started to rain in earnest. Aliena made a snap decision.
"Come with me," she said to Elizabeth.
Before the guard could do anything, she had taken the girl by the hand and walked away. Countess Elizabeth went willingly, grinning like a child let out of school. Aliena had an inkling that the guard might come after them and snatch her away, but at that moment there was a lightning flash and the shower became a storm. Aliena broke into a run, pulling Elizabeth with her, and they raced through the graveyard to a wooden house that stood beside the church. The door stood open. They ran inside. Aliena had assumed this was the priest's house, and she was right. A grumpy-looking man in a black tunic wearing a small cross on a chain around his neck stood up as they entered. Aliena knew that the duty of hospitality was a burden to many parish priests, especially at present. Anticipating resistance, she said firmly, "My companions and I need shelter."
"You're welcome," the priest said through gritted teeth.
It was a two-room house, with a lean-to shed at the side for animals. It was not very clean, even though the animals were kept outside. There was a wine barrel on the table. A small dog yapped at them aggressively as they sat down. Elizabeth pressed Aliena's arm.
"Thank you very much," she said.
There were tears of gratitude in her eyes.
"Ranulph would have made me go on. He never listens to me."
"It was nothing," Aliena said. "These big strong men are all cowards at heart." She studied Elizabeth and realized with a sense of horror that the poor girl looked rather like her. It would be bad enough to be William's wife, but to be his second choice must be hell on earth. Elizabeth said,
"I'm Elizabeth of Shiring. Who are you?"
"My name is Aliena. I'm from Kingsbridge." Aliena held her breath, wondering whether Elizabeth would recognize the name, and realized that Aliena was the woman who had rejected William Hamley. But Elizabeth was too young to remember that scandal, and all she said was,
"What's an unusual name?"
A slovenly woman with a plain face and meaty bare arms came in from the back room, looking defiant, and offered them a cup of wine. Aliena guessed she was the priest's wife. He would probably call her his housekeeper, since clerical marriage was banned in theory. Priests' wives caused no end of trouble. To force the man to put her away was cruel and generally brought shame on the church. And although most people would say in general that priests ought to be chaste, they usually took a permissive line in particular cases because they knew the woman. So the church still turned a blind eye to liaisons such as this. Aliena thought, "Be grateful, woman. At least you're living with your man." The man-at-arms and the carter came in with their hair wet. The guard, Ranulph, stood in front of Elizabeth and said, "We can't stop here." To Aliena's surprise, Elizabeth crumbled immediately.
"All right," she said and stood up.
"Sit down," Aliena said, pulling her back. She stood in front of the guard and wagged her finger in his face. "If I hear another word from you, I'll call the villagers to come to the rescue of the Countess of Shiring. They know how to treat their mistress, even if you don't." She saw Ranulph weighing the odds. If it came to the crunch, he could deal with Elizabeth and Aliena, and the carter and the priest, too. But he would be in trouble if any of the villagers joined in. Eventually, he said, perhaps the Countess would prefer to move on. He looked at Elizabeth aggressively. The girl looked terrified. Aliena said, "Well, your ladyship, Ranulph humbly begs to know your will." Elizabeth looked at her. "Just tell him what you want," Aliena said encouragingly. "His duty is to do your bidding." Aliena's attitude gave Elizabeth courage. She took a deep breath and said, "We'll rest here. Go and see to the horses, Ranulph." He grunted acquiescence and went out. Elizabeth watched him go with an expression of amazement. The carter said, "It's going to piss down." The priest frowned at his vulgarity. "I'm sure it will be just the usual rain," he said in a prissy voice. Aliena could not help laughing, and Elizabeth joined in. Aliena had the feeling the girl did not laugh often. The sound of the rain became a loud drumming. Aliena looked through the open door. The church was only a few yards away, but already the rain had obscured it. This was going to be a real squall. Aliena said to her carter, "Did you put the cart under cover?" The man nodded. "With the beasts." "Good. I don't want my yarn felted." Ranulph came in soaking wet. There was a flash of lightning, followed by a long rumble of thunder. "This will do the crops no good," the priest said lugubriously. He was right, Aliena thought. What they needed was 3 weeks of hot sunshine. There was another flash and a longer crash of thunder, and a gust of wind shook the house. Cold water dropped on Aliena's head, and she looked up to see a drip coming from the thatched roof. She shifted her seat to get out of its way. The rain was blowing in at the door, too, but nobody seemed to want to close it. Aliena preferred to look at the storm, and it seemed the others felt the same. She looked at Elizabeth. The girl was white-faced. Aliena put an arm around her. She was shivering, although it was not cold. Aliena hugged her. "I'm frightened," Elizabeth whispered. "It's only a storm," Aliena said. It became very dark outside. Aliena thought it must be getting near supper time. Then she realized she had not had dinner yet. It was only noon. She got up and went to the door. The sky was iron gray. She had never known such peculiar weather in summer. The wind was gusting strongly. A lightning flash illuminated numerous loose objects blowing past the doorway, a blanket, a small bush, a wooden bowl, an empty barrel. She turned back inside, frowning, and sat down. She was getting mildly worried. The house shook again. The central pole that held up the ridge of the roof was vibrating. This was one of the better-built houses in the village, she reflected. If this was unsteady, some of the poorer places might be in danger of collapse. She looked at the priest. "If it gets any worse, we may have to round up the villagers and all take shelter in the church," she said. "I'm not going out in that," the priest said with a short laugh. Aliena stared at him incredulously. "They're your flock," she said. "You're their shepherd." The priest looked back at her insolently. "I answer to the Bishop of Kingsbridge, not you, and I'm not going to play the fool just because you tell me to." Aliena said, "At least bring the plough team into shelter." The most precious possession of a village such as this was the team of 8 oxen that pulled the plough. Without those beasts, the peasants could not cultivate their land. No individual peasant could afford to own a plough team. It was communal property. The priest would surely value the team, for his prosperity depended on it too. The priest said, "We've no plough team." Aliena was mystified. "Why?" "We had to sell 4 of them to pay rent. Then we killed the others for meat in the winter." That explained the half-sown fields, Aliena thought. They had only been able to cultivate the lighter soils, using horses or manpower to pull the plough. The story angered her. It was foolish as well as hard-hearted of William to make these people sell their plough team, for that meant they would have trouble paying their rents this year too, even though the weather had been fair. It made her want to take William by the neck and strangle him. Another powerful gust shook the wood-framed house. Suddenly one side of the roof seemed to shift. Then it lifted several inches, becoming detached from the wall, and through the gap Aliena saw black sky and forked lightning. She leaped to her feet as the gust subsided, and the thatched roof crashed back down on its supports. This was now becoming dangerous. She stood up and yelled at the priest over the noise of the weather, "At least go and open the church door!" He looked resentful, but he complied. He took a key from a chest, put on a cloak, and went outside, and disappeared into the rain. Aliena began to organize the others. "Carter, take my wagon and oxen into the church. Ranulf, you get the horses. Elizabeth, come with me." They put on their cloaks and went out. It was hard to walk in a straight line because of the wind, and they held hands for stability. They fought their way across the graveyard. The rain had turned to hail, and big pebbles of ice bounced off the tombstones. In a corner of the cemetery, Aliena saw an apple tree as bare as in wintertime. Its leaves and fruit had been ripped off the branches by the gale. "There won't be many apples in the county this autumn," she thought. A moment later, they reached the church and went inside. The sudden hush was like going deaf. The wind still howled, and the rain drummed on the roof, and thunder crashed every few moments, but it was all at one remove. Some of the villagers were here already, their cloaks sodden. They had brought their valuables with them, their chickens in sacks, their pigs trussed, their cows on leads. It was dark in the church, but the scene was illuminated fitfully by lightning. After a few moments the carter drove Aliena's wagon inside, and Ranulf followed with the horses. Aliena said to the priest, "Let's get the beasts to the west end and the people to the east before the church starts to look like a stable." Everyone now seemed to have accepted that Aliena was in charge, and he concurred with a nod. The two of them moved off, the priest talking to the men and Aliena to the women. Gradually the people separated from the animals. The women took the children to the little chancel, and the men tied the animals to the columns of the nave. The horses were frightened, rolling their eyes and prancing. The cows all lay down. The villagers got into family groups and began to pass food and drink around. They had come prepared for a long stay. The storm was so violent that Aliena thought it must pass soon, but instead it got worse. She went to a window. The windows were not made of glass, of course, but of fine translucent linen, which now hung in shreds from the window frames. Aliena pulled herself up to the windowsill to look out, but all she could see was rain. The wind grew stronger, shrieking around the walls of the church, and she began to wonder whether even this was safe. She made a discreet tour of the building. She had spent enough time with Jack to know the difference between good masonry and bad, and she was relieved to see that the stonework here was neat and careful. There were no cracks. The building was made of cut stone blocks, not rubble, and it seemed as solid as a mountain. The priest's housekeeper lit a candle, and that was when Aliena realized night was falling outside. The day had been so dark that the difference was small. The children tired of running up and down the aisles, and curled up in their cloaks to go to sleep. The chickens put their heads under their wings. Elizabeth and Aliena sat side by side on the floor with their backs to the wall. Aliena was consumed with curiosity about this poor girl who had taken on the role of William's wife, the role Aliena herself had refused 17 years ago. Unable to restrain herself, she said, "I used to know William when I was a girl. What's he like now?"
"I loathe him,"
Elizabeth said with passion. Aliena felt deeply sorry for her. Elizabeth said,
"How did you know him?"
Aliena realized she had let herself in for this.
"To tell you the truth, when I was more or less your age, I was supposed to marry him."
"No."
"And how come you didn't?"
"I refused, and my father backed me. But there was a dreadful fuss. I caused a lot of bloodshed. However, it's all in the past."
"You refused him?" Elizabeth was thrilled. "You're so courageous. I wish I was like you." Suddenly she looked downcast again. "But I can't even stand up to the servants."
"You could, you know," Aliena said.
"But how? They just don't take any notice of me because I'm only 14.
Aliena considered the question carefully, then answered comprehensively. "To begin with, you must become the carrier of your husband's wishes. In the morning, ask him what he would like to eat today, whom he wants to see, which horse he would like to ride, anything you can think of. Then go to the kitchener, the steward of the hall, and the stableman, and give them the Earl's orders. Your husband will be grateful to you and angry with anyone who ignores you, so people will get used to doing what you say. Then take note of who helps you eagerly and who reluctantly. Make sure that helpful people are favored, give them the jobs they like to do, and make sure the unhelpful ones get all the dirty work. Then people will start to realize that it pays to oblige the Countess. They will also love you much more than William, who isn't very lovable anyway. Eventually you will become a power in your own right. Most countesses are."
"You make it sound easy,"
Elizabeth said wistfully.
"No, it's not easy. But if you're patient and don't get discouraged too easily, you can do it." "I think I can," she said determinedly. "I really think I can."
Eventually they began to doze. Every now and again the wind would howl and wake Aliena. Looking around in the fitful candlelight, she saw that most of the adults were doing the same, sitting upright, nodding off for a while, then waking up suddenly. It must have been around midnight that she woke with a start, and realized that she had slept for an hour or more this time. Almost everyone around her was fast asleep. She shifted her position, lying flat on the floor, and wrapped her cloak tightly around her. The storm was not letting up, but people's need for sleep had overcome their anxiety. The sound of the rain blowing against the walls of the church was like waves crashing on a beach, and instead of keeping her awake, it now lulled her to sleep. Once again she woke with a start. She wondered what had disturbed her. She listened. Silence. The storm had ended. A faint grey light seeped in through the windows. All the villagers were fast asleep. Aliena got up. Her movement disturbed Elizabeth, who came awake instantly. They both had the same thought. They went to the church door, opened it, and stepped outside. The rain had stopped, and the wind was no more than a breeze. The sun had not yet risen, but the dawn sky was pearl grey. Aliena and Elizabeth looked around them in the clear, watery light. The village was gone. Other than the church, there was not a single building left standing. The entire area had been flattened. A few heavy timbers had come to rest up against the side of the church, but otherwise only the hearthstones dotted around in the sea of mud showed where there had been houses. At the edges of what had been the village, there were 5 or 6 mature trees, oaks and chestnuts, still standing, although each of them appeared to have lost several boughs. There were no young trees left at all. Stunned by the completeness of the devastation, Aliena and Elizabeth walked along what had been the street. The ground was littered with splintered wood and dead birds. They came to the first of the wheat fields. It looked as if a large herd of cattle had been penned there for the night. The ripening stalks of wheat had been flattened, broken, uprooted, and washed away. The earth was churned up and waterlogged. Aliena was horrified.
"Oh, God," she muttered, "what will the people eat?"
They struck out across the field. The damage was the same everywhere. They climbed a low hill and surveyed the surrounding countryside from the top. Every way they looked, they saw ruined crops, dead sheep, blasted trees, flooded meadows and flattened houses. The destruction was appalling, and it filled Aliena with a dreadful sense of tragedy. It looked, she thought, as if the hand of God had come down over England and struck the earth, destroying everything men had made, except churches. The devastation had shocked Elizabeth, too.
"It's terrible," she said. "I can't believe it. There's nothing left."
Aliena nodded grimly. "Nothing," she echoed. "There'll be no harvest this year."
What will the people do?
I don't know. Feeling a mixture of compassion and fear, Aliena said, It's going to be a bloody winter.
2. One morning, 4 weeks after the great storm, Martha asked Jack for more money. Jack was surprised. He already gave her 6 pence a week for housekeeping, and he knew that Aliena gave her the same. On that, she had to feed 4 adults and 2 children and supply 2 houses with firewood and rushes. But there were plenty of big families in Kingsbridge who only had 6 pence a week for everything, food and clothing and rent too. He asked her why she needed more. She looked embarrassed.
All the prices have gone up. The baker wants a penny for a 4-pound loaf and
a penny for a 4-pounder? Jack was outraged. We should make an oven and bake our own.
Well, sometimes I do pan bread.
That's right. Jack realized they had had pan-baked bread 2 or 3 times during the last week or so. Martha said, But the price of flour has gone up too, so we don't save much.
We should buy wheat and grind it ourselves. It's not allowed. We're supposed to use the Priory Mill. Anyway, wheat is expensive also.
Of course. Jack realized he was being silly. Bread was dear because flour was dear, and flour was dear because wheat was dear, and wheat was dear because the storm had wiped out the harvest, and there was no getting away from it. He saw that Martha looked troubled. She always got very upset if she thought he was displeased. He smiled to show her it was all right, and patted her shoulder.
"It's not your fault," he said. "You sound so cross."
"Not with you." He felt guilty. Martha would rather cut off her hand than cheat him, he knew. He did not really understand why she was so devoted to him. If it was love, he thought, surely she would have got fed up by now, for she and the whole world knew that Aliena was the love of his life. He had once contemplated sending her away, to force her out of her rut. That way, perhaps, she would fall for a suitable man. But he knew in his heart that it would not work, and would only make her desperately unhappy. So he let it be. He reached inside his tunic for his purse and took out 3 silver pennies.
"You'd better have 12 pence a week and see if you can manage on that," he said.
It seemed a lot. His pay was only 24 pennies a week, although he got perquisites as well, candles and robes and boots. He swallowed the rest of a mug of beer and went out. It was unusually cold for early autumn. The weather was still strange. He walked briskly along the street and entered the Priory Close. It was still a little before sunrise, and only a handful of craftsmen were here. He walked up the nave, looking at the foundations. They were almost complete, which was fortunate, as the mortar work would probably have to stop early this year, because of the cold weather. He looked up at the new transepts. His pleasure in his own creation was blighted by the cracks. They had reappeared on the day after the great storm. He was terribly disappointed. It had been a phenomenal tempest, of course, but his church was designed to survive 100 such storms. He shook his head in perplexity and climbed the turret stairs to the gallery. He wished he could talk to someone who had built a similar church, but nobody in England had, and even in France they had not yet gone this high. On impulse, he did not go to his tracing floor, but continued up the staircase to the roof. The lead had all been laid, and he saw that the pinnacle that had been blocking the flow of rainwater now had a generous gutter running through its base. It was windy up on the roof, and he tried to keep hold of something whenever he was near the edge. He would not be the first builder to be blown off a roof to his death by a gust of wind. The wind always seemed stronger up here than it did on the ground. In fact, the wind seemed to increase disproportionately as you climbed. He stood still, staring into space. The wind increased disproportionately as you climbed. That was the answer to his puzzle. It was not the weight of his vault that was causing the cracks, it was the height. He had built the church strong enough to bear the weight, he was sure, but he had not thought about the wind. These towering walls were constantly buffeted, and because they were so high, the wind was enough to crack them. Standing on the roof, feeling its force, he could just imagine the effect it was having on the tautly balanced structure below him. He knew the building so well that he could almost feel the strain, as if the walls were part of his body. The wind pushed sideways against the church, just as it was pushing against him, and because the church could not bend, it cracked. He was quite sure he had found the explanation, but what was he going to do about it? He needed to strengthen the clerestory so that it could withstand the wind, but how? To build massive buttresses up against the walls would destroy the stunning effect of lightness and grace that he had achieved so successfully. But if that was what it took to make the building stand up, he would have to do it. He went down the stairs again. He felt no more cheerful, even though he had finally understood the problem, for it looked as if the solution would destroy his dream. "Perhaps I was arrogant," he thought. "I was so sure I could build the most beautiful cathedral in the world. Why did I imagine I could do better than anyone else? What made me think I was special? I should have copied another master's design exactly and been content." Philip was waiting for him at the tracing floor. There was a worried frown on the prior's brow, and the fringe of graying hair around his shaved head was untidy. He looked as if he had been up all night. "We've got to reduce our expenditure," he said without preamble. "We just haven't got the money to carry on building at our present rate." Jack had been afraid of this. The hurricane had destroyed the harvest throughout most of southern England. It was sure to have an effect on the priory's finances. Talk of cutbacks always made him anxious. In his heart he was afraid that if building slowed down too much, he might not live to see his cathedral completed. But he did not let his fear show. "Winter's coming," he said casually. "Work always slows down then anyway. And winter will be early this year." "Not early enough," Philip said grimly. "I want to cut our outgoings in half immediately." "In half?" It sounded impossible. "The winter layoff begins today." This was worse than Jack had anticipated. The summer workers normally left around the beginning of December. They spent the winter months building wooden houses or making ploughs and carts, either for their families or to earn money. This year the families would not be pleased to see them. Jack said, "Do you know you're sending them to homes where people are already starving?" Philip just stared back at him angrily. "Of course you know it," Jack said. "Sorry I asked." Philip said forcefully, "If I don't do this now, then one Saturday in midwinter the entire workforce will stand in line for their pay, and I will show them an empty chest." Jack shrugged helplessly. "There's no arguing with that." "It's not all," Philip warned. "From now on there's to be no hiring, even to replace people who leave." "We haven't been hiring for months." "You hired Alfred." "That was different." Jack was embarrassed. "Anyway, no hiring. And no upgrading." Jack nodded. Every now and again an apprentice or a laborer asked to be upgraded to mason or stonecutter. If the other craftsman judged that his skills were adequate, the request would be granted, and the priory would have to pay him higher wages. Jack said, "Upgrading is the prerogative of the mason's lodge." "I'm not trying to alter that," Philip said. "I'm asking the masons to postpone all promotions until the famine is over." "I'll put it to them," Jack said non-committally. He had a feeling there could be trouble over that. Philip pressed on. "From now on there'll be no work on saints' days." There were too many saints' days. In principle there were holidays, but whether workers were paid for the holiday was a matter for negotiation. At Kingsbridge, the rule was that when two or more saints' days fell in the same week, the first was a paid holiday and the second was an unpaid optional day off. Most people chose to work the second. Now, however, they would not have that option. The second saint's day would be an obligatory, unpaid holiday. Jack was feeling uncomfortable about the prospect of explaining these changes to the lodge. He said, "All this would go down a lot better if I could present it to them as a matter for discussion, rather than as something already settled." Philip shook his head. "Then they'd think it was open to negotiation, and some of the proposals might be softened. They'd suggest working half the saint's days and allowing a limited number of upgrades." He was right, of course. "But isn't that reasonable?" Jack said. "Of course it's reasonable,"
Philip said irritably. It's just that there's no room for adjustment. I've already worried that these measures won't be sufficient. I can't make any concessions.
All right, Jack said. Philip was clearly in no mood to compromise right now. Is there anything else? He said warily.
Yes. Stop buying supplies. Run down your stocks of stone, iron, and timber.
We get the timber free, Jack protested, but we have to pay for it to be carted here.
True.
All right. Jack went to the window and looked down at the stones and tree trunks stacked in the priory close. It was a reflex action. He already knew how much he had in stock.
That's not a problem, he said after a moment. With the reduced workforce, we've got enough materials to last until next summer.
Philip sighed wearily. There's no guarantee we'll be taking on summer workers next year, he said. It all depends on the price of wool. You'd better warn them.
Jack nodded. It's as bad as that, is it?
It's worse than I've ever known it, Philip said. What this country needs is 3 years of good weather and a new king.
Amen to that, said Jack.
Philip returned to his house. Jack spent the morning wondering how to handle the changes. There were two ways to build a nave, bay by bay, beginning at the crossing and working west, or course by course, laying the base of the entire nave first, and then working up. The second way was faster but required more masons. It was the method Jack had intended to use. Now he reconsidered. Building bay by bay was more suited to a reduced workforce. It had another advantage, too. Any modifications he introduced into his design to take account of wind resistance could be tested in one or two bays before being used throughout the building. He also brooded over the long-term effect of the financial crisis. Work might slow down more and more over the years. Gloomily, he saw himself growing old and grey and feeble without achieving his life's ambition, and eventually being buried in the priory graveyard in the shadow of a still unfinished cathedral. When the noon bell rang, he went to the mason's lodge. The men were sitting down to their ale and cheese, and he noticed for the first time that many of them had no bread. He asked the masons who normally went home to dinner if they would stay for a moment. "The priory is running short of money," he said.
"I've never known a monastery that didn't sooner or later," said one of the older men.
Jack looked at him. He was called Edward Two-Nose, because he had a wart on his face almost as big as his nose. He was a good stone carver with a sharp eye for exact curves, and Jack always used him for shafts and drums. Jack said, "You'd have to admit that this place manages its money better than most, but Prior Philip can't avert storms and bad harvests, and now he needs to reduce his expenditure. I'll tell you about it before you have your dinners. First of all, we're not taking in any more supplies of stone or timber." The craftsmen from the other lodges were drifting in to listen. One of the old carpenters, Peter, said,
"The wood we've got won't last the winter."
"Yes, it will," Jack said. "We'll be building more slowly because we'll have fewer craftsmen. The winter layoff starts today." He knew immediately that he had handled the announcement wrongly. There were protests from all sides, several men speaking at once. "I should have broken it to them gently," he thought. But he had no experience of this kind of thing. He had been master for 7 years, but in that time there had been no financial crises. The voice that emerged from the hubbub was that of Pierre Paris, one of the masons who had come from Saint-Denis. After 6 years in Kingsbridge, his English was still imperfect, and his anger made his accent thicker, but he was not discouraged.
"You cannot dismiss men on a Tuesday," he said.
"That's right," said Jack Blacksmith. "You have to give them until the end of the week at least."
Jack's stepbrother Alfred chimed in.
"I remember when my father was building a house for the Earl of Sharing, and Will Hamley came and dismissed the whole crew. My father told him he had to give everyone a week's wages, and held his horse's head until he handed over the money."
"Thank you for nothing, Alfred," thought Jack. He said doggedly, "You might as well hear the rest. From now on, there's no work on saints' days and no promotions." That made them angrier.
"Unacceptable," someone said, and several of the others repeated it. "Unacceptable, unacceptable."
Jack found that infuriating.
What are you talking about? If the Priory hasn't got the money, you're not going to get paid. What's the point of chanting unacceptable, unacceptable, like a class of schoolboys learning Latin?
Edward Two Nose spoke up again. We're not a class of schoolboys, we're a lodge of masons, he said. The lodge has the right of promotion, and nobody can take it away.
And if there's no money for the extra pay? Jack said hotly.
One of the younger masons said, I don't believe that.
It was Dan Bristol, one of the summer workers. He was not a skillful cutter, but he could lay stones very accurately and fast. Jack said to him, How can you say you don't believe it? What do you know about the Priory's finances?
I know what I see, Dan said. Are the monks starving? No. Are there candles in the church? Yes. Is there wine in the stores? Yes. Does the prior go barefoot? No. There's money. He just doesn't want to give it to us.
Several people agreed loudly. In fact, he was wrong about at least one item, and that was the wine. But no one would believe Jack now. He had become the representative of the Priory. That was not fair. He was not responsible for Philip's decisions. He said, Look, I'm only telling you what the prior said to me. I don't guarantee that it's true. But if he tells us there's not enough money and we don't believe him, what can we do?
We can all stop work, said Dan. Immediately.
That's right, said another voice.
This was getting out of control, Jack realized with a sense of panic.
Wait a moment, he said.
Desperately, he searched for something to say that would bring down the temperature. Let's go back to work now, and this afternoon I'll try to persuade Prior Philip to moderate his plans.
I don't think we should work, Dan said.
Jack could not believe this was happening. He had anticipated many threats to the building of his dream church, but he had not foreseen that the craftsmen would sabotage it.
Why shouldn't we work? He said incredulously. What's the point?
Dan said, As things stand, half of us aren't even sure we're going to get paid for the rest of the week.
Which is against all custom and practice, said Pierre Paris.
The phrase custom and practice was much used in court. Jack said desperately, At least work while I'm trying to talk Philip around.
Edward Two Nose said, If we work, can you guarantee that everyone will be paid for the whole week?
Jack knew he could offer no such guarantee with Philip in his present mood. It crossed his mind to say yes anyway, and pay the money himself if necessary. But he realized immediately that his entire savings would not be enough to cover a week's wages here. So he said, I'll do my level best to persuade him, and I think he'll agree.
Not good enough for me, said Dan.
Nor me, said Pierre.
Dan said, No guarantee, no work. To Jack's dismay, there was general agreement. He saw that if he continued to oppose them, he would lose what little authority he had left. The lodge must act as one man, he said, quoting a much-used form of words. Are we all in favor of a stoppage? There was a chorus of assent. So be it, Jack said dismally. I'll tell the prior.
Bishop Walleran rode into Shiring, followed by a small army of attendants. Earl William was waiting for him in the porch of the church on the market square. William frowned in puzzlement. He had been expecting a site meeting, not a state visit. What was the devious bishop up to now? With Walleran was a stranger on a chestnut gelding. The man was tall and rangy, with heavy black eyebrows and a large, curved nose. He wore a scornful expression that seemed permanent. He rode beside Walleran as if they were equals, but he was not wearing the clothes of a bishop. When they dismounted, Walleran introduced the stranger.
Earl William, this is Peter of Wareham, who is an archdeacon in the service of the Archbishop of Canterbury.
No explanation of what Peter is doing here, William thought. Walleran is definitely up to something. The archdeacon bowed and said, Your bishop has told me of your generosity to Holy Mother Church, Lord William. Before William could reply, Walleran pointed to the parish church.
This building will be pulled down to make room for the new church, archdeacon, he said.
Have you appointed a master mason yet? Peter asked.
William wondered why an archdeacon from Canterbury was so interested in the parish church of Shiring, but perhaps he was just being polite.
No, I haven't found a master yet,
Walleran said. There are plenty of builders looking for work, but I can't get anyone from Paris. It seems the whole world wants to build churches like Saint-Denis, and the masons who know the